Ahoy, hoy, everybody. Welcome to the Talking Simpsons Patreon interview show. We don't have a really good name for this yet, but this is sort of our space to interview people associated with animation. I mean, this is not just a Simpsons Patreon. It is also an animation Patreon. And Henry's here as well. Hello, Henry.
Hey, it's me too. Yeah, we obviously have that goal of the animation conversation show and start that.
Yeah.
But in general, we want this to be more of a celebration of animation. And so we reached out to somebody who turns out is also a listener of the show, too.
Actually, Henry did all the work. So please thank Henry nicely. He set all of this up, and it turned out really well.
This next is a conversation with Ian Jones-Cordy. So just a quick setup for him, if you don't know him. He, first of all, the creator of OKKO, this new show currently on Cartoon Network, which I am loving. It is such a funny, exciting show.
It's really fun to watch. It's funny, and it's very visually inventive and interesting.
Yeah, but he also has a ton of other experience, too, that he worked on. He had worked on Steven Universe. He was a former executive producer on that. He was the animation director on Venture Brothers, which, honestly, we're recording this after the interview. There's one regret. I did not ask him enough about Venture Brothers, but there's only an hour.
He's done too many things.
I know.
He's younger than me.
Yes, and he worked on Adventure Time, which we don't really touch on either.
Right.
But he's also a big time like gamer, animation fan, Simpsons fan,
anime fan. Yeah.
So we have a lot in common with him as like
basically nerds who grew up in the 90s.
Nerds who grew up in the 90s and love very similar things.
Yes.
So, yeah. And it was great to dig into this with him. He's such a cool guy. So yeah, I guess listen and enjoy. Well, hey there, Ian. Hey, I first wanted to ask, I see a lot of influence from your childhood in OKKO, so I was curious, like, what was it like to be a nerdy kid growing up in the 90s?
I don't know. I think it was a really great time. I think I was really lucky. Definitely people of my generation were really lucky to live through the, like, rapid development of video games. Like, getting to see... Like, I feel kind of sorry for kids who didn't get to see, like, have the, like, 2600 be their first system and see, like, everything, like, grow and change overnight and, like, you know, get a Super Nintendo and a Sega Genesis and think, wow, it's never going to get better than this. And then just see, like, you know, everything open up, see, like, you know, more developers and more, like, to where we are, like, at this time, it seems like the most amazing time for video games and cartoons, and you know, we've seen media become like so much more like niche, and I don't know, I think it's just amazing. Like as a kid, like I got Cartoon Network when it like started, and like that was like a huge deal for me to just have like, wow, there's a cable channel that shows nothing but cartoons all day. I don't know. It was great.
Yeah, I remember too. I had that same thing of like, wow, this could be Penelope Pit Stop straight into her wacky races. I will watch it all day.
Yeah, I think being obsessed with things in the 90s might have been more gratifying because you had to go out and personally seek out all the information yourself, like,
that's
you know,
true.
Collecting tapes of shows. Now I turn on a streaming network and there's like 300 episodes of an anime and I'm like, this is too much immediately.
It's like, it's so fun because like, yeah, when I go back and like watch old like Mystery Science Theater 3000 episodes, it's sort of like, how did they allow this to be on TV? And then you just remember that like, oh, these cable networks are new. They had like no programming. Like a show like this could thrive at that time. Like I feel really lucky to have lived through that.
Well, you talked about video games. We just did a whole Retronauts on Yoshi's Island, and I know you said that's been like a huge influence in you in general. Like,
oh,
what?
Yeah.
What's so special about that game to you?
So yeah, for me, I mean, I don't know how blasphemous this is going to sound, but it feels like Nintendo's last super great 2D platformer. I feel like there's been like, you know, in like that classic era of Nintendo 2D platformers, obviously they've gone back and done things since, like, you know, really good and amazing stuff. But it feels like it was like the pinnacle of, you know, you had all these designers and all these artists like at the top of their game, like before they all sort of spread out and eventually like started directing like their own games.
Right.
You know, it was like really important to me. And also, just as an artist, the art style was a huge revelation for me, because I had never seen something that, like, the way that form and function worked in that game. So, like, you know, they had, like, the kind of, with all the sprite rotations and scaling and stuff, so it gave everything this kind of chunky, pixelated kind of feel. And so they took that and kind of made that, like, the entire aesthetic of the game. There's something that's really gratifying about that to me, and it's something that I've tried to sort of echo in OKKO, where, you know, because the show is hand animated, we work with the animation studio really closely and all the designers. We've given them this edict to keep the drawings in pencil, so they kind of have this, like, rough, sketchy sort of outline to them. So there's, like, a little noise and a little, like, grit to all of the lines. Like, it doesn't feel super polished and super smooth. And I think that's something that I really learned from Yoshi's Island, like, studying the aesthetic style of that game.
That actually ties into a question about the animation of OKKO. I really wanted to ask, as someone who's obsessed with animation but maybe not clear on all the granular elements of it, I was very impressed by how a digital show could emulate the sort of warmth and physicality of classic cell animation. Can you go into the challenges of that? Is that necessarily a more expensive process than sort of the other digital shows that just feel like there are established shapes that are sort of just moved around, not individual drawings for every frame of the show?
Well, yeah, thanks so much. That was definitely a goal of mine. You know, before I get into the production thing of it, like, you know, I mentioned Yoshi's Island, but also a huge one of my influences is Simpsons, especially, like, much earlier Simpsons. Season one, actually, in particular, like, it's something that a lot of people, like, look at season one and they're like, oh, it's so weird, it's not really the show. But to me, it's, like, it's so charming. Like, this, it's got this, like, roughness and grit to it. And it's something that I really wanted to kind of call back to and make sure that the show had this, like, lively feeling, so that, like, you never in your head forget that, oh, these are drawings, these are funny drawings, these are funny expressions. They're, like, weird drawings, like, stuff like that. But to sort of go into kind of, like, the feel of the show, so, yeah, I had this goal of kind of trying to make the show feel, yeah, warm and kind of retro in that way. I think the interesting thing about a lot of animation, you know, there are shows that we know, like, say, like, Rick and Morty or BoJack Horseman, that are, like, they're done in Flash. The animation is done by people, but it's drawn directly into the computer. And so you get a lot of, like, asset reuse and sort of, like, the feel of something moving. When something moves around, a lot of times it's, like, the same image sort of being puppeted around. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I think that's actually, it's a really effective technique, especially for, like, those shows where, like, the characters are sort of supposed to keep this sort of, like, flat consistency to them. And I think that's definitely one way to go. However, on all the shows I've worked on, we've gone sort of another way. So, for instance, Adventure Time, which I worked on, Steven Universe, which I also worked on, The Venture Brothers, which was one of my first jobs in animation as an animation director, and my show, are all animated traditionally. So instead of using Flash and sort of puppeting drawings around, every single movement, every single frame is drawn by an animator. So, you know, even though they look slick, like something like Adventure Time or Steven Universe, people believe that, oh, are these like vector lines? Are these like Flash animated drawings? They're not. In fact, it takes like a lot of work to get that sort of line consistency. Steven Universe, like, I've been in Korea and I've watched these artists like ink these drawings, and it is the most incredible thing you've ever seen. You would think that a machine, no one could do like it with that high level of skill, but these are all like hand-drawn, hand-inked drawings.
Wow.
And sort of one of the things I wanted to do was really highlight that. And so when talking with the animation studios and also my pre-production team, I've had like the creative edict of, hey, let's never forget that these are drawings. Make sure that you have the feel of like the hand-drawn, like hand-inked line in there. And so it came down to even, let's just do the entire show in pencil. And basically what they do is they animate all of the layouts and animation in pencil, like traditionally, like on a light table for everything. In fact, I tweeted like months ago, like an image of like someone flipping like one of my scenes, like on paper, you know, like, these are like, this is done like the old school way.
Hmm.
And basically
awesome.
What they do is they take those drawings, scan those drawings, and they color them in this process where they keep the line work, the rough line work on top, and they sort of color the spaces under it. So it has like, you know, this sort of bright colored in feel, but it retains like that hand drawn line.
Oh man, that's amazing.
That's fascinating.
Especially all that, as a kid, I would see those animation specials like from Disney and they'd show that the different frames on paper, but it's great that they're still doing that with your show. Like I just figured it was all in the past now.
Oh no. It's actually like incredibly common. And I would say like, there's a lot of shows, like current shows, that still use that process. I would say the majority of the flagship shows at Cartoon Network, you know, Adventure Time, Steven Universe, Ben 10, Wee Bear Bears, like we all use that process. This is like 100% hand-drawn animation. Yeah.
That's great to hear.
You know, you mentioned The Simpsons, so yeah, I was going to ask if you were a Simpsons fan growing up, that the stuff about the animation, it's something I kind of wish I'd focused on a little more earlier on the show, that Bob and I are writers, I think, so maybe we come at it of just like, oh, the writers who wrote the show, and then it gets animated, but
yeah.
But like, so did it have influence on you as an animator, The Simpsons? I would guess it did.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I do... There's something that I've done like throughout my career. So, you know, I'll sit down and I'll marathon The Simpsons. Basically, I'll do like 1 through 9 or 1 through 8.5 of 9. and I will basically like, I will go back every couple of years and do that. The things that I've learned throughout my career in how to put a show together and how to make a show really changes the way that I look at certain episodes and certain the way that I look at certain sequences in The Simpsons. Like, for instance, I don't know, I would say Itchy and Scratchy and Marge, amazing episode all about animation, something I really like. The sequence in that show where all the kids, because they don't like the show anymore, they go outside and play. like, watching a sequence like that, it had an effect on me, and I was like, wow, this is really well animated, really well done. I watch it now and I'm like looking at all the layouts that they did, like all the like awesome camera cheats that they did to like affect things. There's like these incredible bipack shots where they're using foreground elements, wiping the screen, and then they cut to like a different layout of all the characters doing something. Like there's like some really like technically impressive like animation in that show. And it was something that was like a huge, huge, huge influence on me. It was one of my big influences. I mean, along with Ren and Stimpy and Dexter's Lab, but like that, yeah, it was huge for me.
Yeah, I remember that like super long panning shot where they kind of hide, like they hide one cut between a frisbee, like a frisbee will cover the screen.
And, yeah, that was a Jim Reardon episode. He's a masterclass animator.
He's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Also, that episode, is it true that pies are easy to draw? Are they easier to draw than ice cream?
I mean, I feel like that's kind of just a writer-y joke.
Yes.
yeah, I don't know. We did an episode with a pie fight at the end, and it was super fun. So, I don't know. Maybe they're right.
well, yeah, you mentioned Dexter's Lab. That was, I definitely... I'd seen you mention it in other interviews, but I could definitely see it in OKKO, a bit of Dexter's Lab, which was, I really love Powerpuff Girls, but I think that was my favorite original What a Cartoon was Dexter's Lab. And I especially would love episodes that when I'd see like, this is an anime. I know these people are watching the same anime I watched and are drawing it. It was just so like, what did you love about Dexter so much?
Yeah. And I've mentioned this before, but yeah, it's sort of like, the thing about Dexter's, and I guess it would maybe kind of extend back a little even to Two Stupid Dogs, where a lot of those directors started. Dexter's really, for me, was a huge sea change for me, because as a kid, I liked cartoons a lot. I loved every cartoon that existed. I loved Looney Tunes. I loved Hanna-Barbera. Like, even, like, the depths of, like, worst-seeming Hanna-Barbera stuff. Like, I ate all that stuff up. I loved it so much.
Like the Groovy Ghoulie,
the Hair Bear Bunch.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I would watch all that stuff. That's, like, my favorite. That was, like, my favorite stuff growing up. But then also, like, as a kid, I was able to, like, because I was voracious about animation, I got my hands on, you know, I got my hands on anime through fan subs. Like, my cousin had fan subs of Dragon Ball, and, like, I was watching, like, things, and, you know, I started, eventually, when they started showing anime on TV, like, Sci-Fi Channel, like, I was, like, recording all those things and, like, studying them, like, trying to figure out how they did stuff. Dexter's Lab, for me, was, like, a huge aha moment, because Dexter's Lab is in this hybrid style that I've, like, taken to calling Hanna-Barbaname, which is, like, basically they took the static layouts and limited animation of Hanna-Barbera and mixed it with sort of, like, the dynamic motion and camera work of anime and sort of fused it into this one hybrid style, which was super inspiring to me as a kid because I love those anime things, but I felt like, well, but I like drawing cartoons, so I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to do that. And then I saw these shows, and I was just like, wow, I can put things that I like all together in one piece of art. And that was hugely inspiring to me.
Well, yeah, have you met with Genndy Tartakovsky? And I'm sure you must have told him about this stuff.
Oh, yeah. I've definitely fanboyed.
This is going pretty deep, but I remember the second run of Dexter's Lab looked very different, and it wasn't really appreciated at the time, but I went back to it recently on Netflix or Hulu or whatever, and I'm like, wow, somehow this is even more of an artist-driven and conceptual show than the first run. How did you feel about that that era of Dexter's Lab? It was very different.
Oh, man. It was very different. I honestly, those episodes, I just think the background paintings are gorgeous.
Oh, yeah.
I love, like, the art direction and the background paintings. It's just, like, they're very, very pretty. When I would watch those episodes, I would be appreciating them for that, yeah.
Now, I remember watching them, too, and thinking, like, maybe it was just that, you know, it was feeling like the post-Samurai Jack show, but it was like, oh, this is darker colors and feels even, like, darker than the first run.
You can feel, like, a lot of, like, the brush strokes and, like, the background art. There's some very, like, beautiful stuff there.
Yeah. Well, also, as a comic book fan, I just loved seeing... Well, I'm being able to recognize, like, oh, this dial-in for monkey stuff, like, this is a lot of Jim Stronko S.H.I.E.L.D. stuff.
Oh, yeah.
This is so much Jack Kirby in it, too. I love that.
Yeah, I loved that, too. And, yeah, it was a huge, I mean, if you've seen OKKO, you can probably tell it's a huge influence on me to see somebody just sort of dive into the things that they love and reinterpret it in their own way and just have fun with all of the archetypes of superheroes and anime and cartoons that you grew up with and just having fun with those concepts.
Going back a little bit to games, like, were you more of a Sonic or Mario guy?
Well, man, I loved both growing up. However, when it came to 16-bit, actually, as a kid, Super Mario Brothers 3 was, like, my favorite game. Mm-hmm. And it's still, like, one of my favorites. But at 16-bit, controversially, I got a Genesis instead of a Super Nintendo.
Yes.
Because my friends owned Super Nintendo, so I always felt like, well, I could play that over at their house if I want to. But I feel like I grew up sort of appreciating both. I know that there's this, like, Sonic-Mario dichotomy, but I think a lot of that comes from people who played Super Mario World and loved it, and then they played Sonic, and then they were like, hey, this isn't Super Mario World. This is bad. And then they just were like, you know, they just are like, and that's why there's all these, like, articles and think pieces, like, Sonic was always bad. And it's usually from, like, a point of view where they're like, well, it wasn't Mario, so I didn't like it. It's always like, to me, I guess I always saw them as two different games with completely different aims. So, yeah, I really loved both of them. And I loved, like, the art style of classic Sonic and classic Mario. Those were, like, huge influences on me. Just, like, the clear silhouettes, the clear like lines, the like very expressive cartooning of those characters. And what's interesting is that like limitations of those systems like made them have to be like more deliberate and more clear with like their cartooning of those characters. And I think it really pays off.
And I know you were involved a little bit with the Sonic Mania animated opening, like that thing was so gorgeous. Because I always thought, well, the best animated Sonic will always be the Sonic CD opening.
Oh yeah.
But then I saw the Mania opening. I'm like, oh my god, this is even.
When I was a kid, I didn't have a Sega CD original. I eventually bought one, but I didn't have one, and I was in, I think, like Radio Shack or like Sears Funtronics, and they had one. And I saw that intro, and it wasn't, the Sega CD that they had hooked up had no controllers. So they were just playing the Sonic CD attract mode on loop.
Wow, what a tease.
And I just like sat there and watched it over and over and over. And I was like, this is my life. This is like the greatest thing I've ever seen. And it inspired so much of like my work. I was constantly trying to animate something that cool. And then I just happened to have, through animation connections, I just happened to have some friends who were involved in the production on the Sonic Mania intro, and they reached out to me. And you know, I'm running an animated TV show, so I have like no time. I have like my schedule is so busy, like I have like no time to like work on personal work or anything else. But they approached me and they're like, hey, we're doing this Sonic intro, like, do you think you could animate a couple shots? And I was just like, I will clear my schedule, I will do whatever it takes.
I'll cancel my show.
So to me. Yeah, so I ended up animating two shots for that intro, and it was like, it was a dream come true.
I did want to talk about the influence anime has had on you, because I feel like we're now just starting to get into an era in which creators are now deeply influenced by anime, instead of, you know, people saying, well, I guess the kids like anime, let's make our show look like that. Can you talk about the titles you liked and sort of just how you appreciate the craftsmanship and the style?
Yeah. Let me see. Gosh, I would say like super early on, like the things that had like big influences on me were, well, I would say some of my hugest influences would be like Project Aiko. just mind-blowing to me, seeing that kind of action. Definitely, like, a lot of the classics. Ninja Scroll was huge in my childhood. I played that over and over. Evangelion was, like, just, like, one of those, like, early teenage mind-blow kind of, like, oh, my gosh. Like, a cartoon can do this? Like, I'm so smart now, you know?
Just like reading a book.
Yeah, exactly. But one of my hugest influences actually is a early Miyazaki series called Future Boy Conan.
Oh yeah,
Future Boy Conan is like it's just like one of the best animes I've ever watched. It's basically this was post the second series of Lupin the Third. Miyazaki directed a couple episodes of that, and he eventually had his own series, which I think was aired on, I think it was maybe like a public television network in Japan at the time. And he directed the series. He directed all of the episodes, I think, except for two that I think maybe I don't want to misattribute who did that. But he directed all the episodes in this show. And if you like the Miyazaki film Castle in the Sky, you'll love this show, Laputa. This show is like that, but kind of blown out over 26 episodes. It's got everything that I think is really cool. It's got planes, mech.
Of course.
It's got a super strong kid who like does all this really amazing action. It's got like the pure love of children, which is like the best thing in like a Miyazaki thing, where it's just like, you know, there's a boy and a girl and they just love each other with no questions asked, and it's like they're risking their lives to like save each other. And you know, it's just like mind-blowing and super fun. If you ever have a chance to watch Future Boy Conan, I would say dig into it, because it's like, it's one of my favorite Miyazaki things. You know, that and That and Porco Rosso.
Yeah, I've always been meaning to. It's been hard to see, and it's never been officially localized in the U.S., I think. After I watched Nadia's Secret of Blue Water and then saw clips of shots from Future Boy, like, hey, wait a minute.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that anime influence, too, I could definitely see on the show. One of my favorite moments of that was in TKO when you guys had the eye catches, especially with the, like, not for resale Chiron just on the screen. That's so great, funny.
And when characters are introduced, you see all the text pop into the screen that describe who they are and their powers and their level and things. I love that so much in anime. It's great to see it in your show.
Oh, thanks so much. Yeah, I would say, like, and it kind of goes along with that sort of the observation you mentioned, Bob, is about sort of trying to emulate that warmth and feeling of, like, it being like a lazy Saturday afternoon and you're just watching, like, some old cartoons or anime or something. And I like to, like, put in things that, like, just take you back to that sort of feeling and create that feeling for kids who never got to experience it.
Speaking of, like, kids, and there's something I really like about KO on the show in that he feels in a way like a throwback, but he also feels like a modern day kid. Like he has a binder full of cards, which I remember having as a kid for all my Marvel cards, but he also has his own video channel, or he goes into a phone booth and has no clue what a phone booth is. Like, so how do you balance that and making him feel like a kid today, but also mixing in that kind of nostalgia life as a kid?
I've been blessed with an amazing crew of writers and artists. We all get on the same wavelength, and our sort of feeling is we want to make a show for kids, but we also want to make the show that we would have loved as kids. And so those two things kind of end up working together, and we think about things that, oh, when we were a kid, what was the coolest thing? What was the stuff we liked? And we try to, like, make a show about that. But then we also think about, like, well, you know, what do actual kids like? Like, you know, we don't see that as something that hampers us. I think a lot of times the conversation about people working in animation is, oh, you had to make this thing for kids, but you really wanted to do, like, an adult cartoon, right? that's like, not how we feel at all. Like, we love making stuff for kids. And the most gratifying times on the show have been when, you know, actual kids will, like, you know, like, we'll be at conventions, and it's fun when adults come up and, like, are asking for, like, things. But, like, when a kid comes up, they understand the show on, like, such a more real level than an adult can understand it, because they get that it's just like, oh, it's a world of cool stuff. A lot of times, actually, this harkens back to the Simpsons quote to Itchy and Scratchy and Poochie, where they say, you want a completely down-to-earth show that's off the wall and swarming with magic robots. That's literally the show I made.
Yeah, that's true.
Oh, my God. I didn't think of it like that. I really love the show and how it kind of deals with some tougher topics, like in Everybody Loves Rad, the stuff about stereotyping, and then in No More POW Cards, about basically the whole conversation Dende and KO have about enjoying something that they also know is problematic. Like, obviously that was really important for you guys to want to deal with those kind of subjects on the show.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, we're not trying to do it in a way where we're trying to tell an adult audience, like, oh, this is how you should feel about this. It's more just like, these are things that as a kid, like, I had to navigate. Like, I don't want to go too dark, but, you know, as a little kid who was obsessed with Looney Tunes, I mean, there's some troubling stuff in some Looney Tunes cartoons. But the thing is, like, it didn't stop me from loving it. I mean, one of my favorite Looney Tunes of all time is in The Censored Eleven, Cole Black and the Seven Dwarfs. I mean, it's, like, beautifully animated. The timing is so good. The drawings are so amazing. There's, like, this Rod Scribner animation that is, like, it's, like, mind-blowing, right? But then I also have to square the circle of, like, well, it's also, like, very hurtful, like, to me personally, like, as a black person. Like, but I have to sort of, like, you know, I had that moment, like, as a kid that Kay and Dendy have, where they're, like, oh, this thing is a problem. Do I cut it out of my life, or do I have a more realistic, and academic appreciation of it, where I can say, look, there are some things about this that are very bad. However, on like a technical level, I love this thing, and I think it's like a well-made piece of art.
It has its problems, but, you know, I can like it for what it means to me. And for a lot of kids, that's just where the conversation ends. They just have to accept it, which is why we did that fake Star Wipe ending, by the way. But, you know, their story wasn't over, and I think they reacted to it the way that I did when I was a kid. And even though I like Cole Black on a technical level, the depictions and a lot of the jokes and a lot of the things in the cartoon are really hurtful and racist and wrong. And Kao and Dendi realize that too about the thing that they like. And they use that knowledge to never stop criticizing or asking questions. And they even speak truth to power and let their voices be heard, which changes the system totally and makes a much more equitable future, which is a story that I really want to have out there.
Yeah, you know, I actually had that kind of moment recently too. Of it was a moment that I didn't really think about too much as a kid, but when I was rewatching Cowboy Bebop recently, which is one of my all-time favorite shows ever, and Jupiter Jazz, that two-parter is probably my favorite two episodes of the whole show. But they meet cross-dressing character, and I'm just like,
there's some rough stuff in there.
I was like, boy, I don't like this. This really makes me, so I can totally understand that. So I did want to ask about guest stars on the show. Have just been like amazing to me, especially when I don't even recognize them at first and then see it in the credits, like Keith David, Marina Sirtis, LeVar Burton, like Carol Kane. Yeah. And the biggest one to me was like when I saw that Jonathan Davis of Korn was on the show. I was like, how do you go about getting those kind of guest stars? What's your approach to casting for that kind of stuff?
Well, I think, you know, it's something that we sort of all talk about as a crew. When how we make the shows is, you know, we basically, the board artists get a outline and then they draw a storyboard and then they pitch it to the room and we all kind of talk about it. I mean, this is the way they pitch Hanna-Barbera cartoons and Disney cartoons and Warner Brothers cartoons. It's a very like old school process. We basically sit in a room, we look at all the jokes, we try and figure out like what's funny and stuff. In that process, like when you're pitching, you know, to sell like your jokes, you do different voices for all of the characters as you're selling the jokes. A lot of times, like, we get hung up on a character and be like, oh my gosh, like, what a funny character, what a funny voice that would be. Like, do we know any actors who could do that? And in the case of someone like Jonathan Davis, that was in an episode called Know Your Mom that was storyboarded by Parker Simmons and Ryan Shannon. And part of the idea about that episode was we were like, oh, we're going to bring back one of Kao's mom's old villains. And then we thought about, like, you know, oh, well, what would an old villain be like in the show's current year? And so we were like, what if it was like an early 2000s rap rock new metal guy? And after they pitched it, it was hilarious. And then we were like, what if we actually got someone to do that? And we literally just reached out to Jonathan Davis personally, and he was super into it. And the record was hilarious. Like, he just, like, every time he looked at the script, he started laughing. Like, oh my gosh. Like, do you want me to sing this? Because this is one of my songs. Like, you know, it was just like, it was really great. He was super sweet.
That's awesome. You know, that moment for me watching it was a kind of like, oh, I'm that old moment of, I felt like, oh yeah, if I had a kid who was 6 to 11, like KO is, then that would be the ancient past to that kid. I was like, oh my gosh, that would be that long ago. It was crazy to me.
Yeah, we had that moment of being like, oh, well, if it's an old villain, like, I guess if it was, say, like, I don't know, a show in the 90s and they wanted someone to look outdated, they would do, like, I don't know, like a disco joke or something like that, you know? But I think, like, we have to do something different because, yeah, it's current year.
It needs to be JNCO jeans instead of bell bottoms.
Exactly.
You mentioned the board artist. That was something, too, I wanted to talk about, that you're very upfront of, like, the, you know, storyboard is a credit right up front, right under the titles. You also mentioned, you know, growing up, Ren and Stimpy and The Simpsons. And those are two very different shows from, like, creative standpoint, right? Because Simpsons is script-driven by writers who then give it to the animators, while Ren and Stimpy, like, John Kay was very clear of, like, this is an artist-driven show. Like, so what's your feeling? Obviously, you have your own feelings on that, too.
For me, the artist-driven cartoon is, in my opinion, the best way. You know, it's the thing that I personally enjoy the most. I love seeing the touches from the individual artist. And it goes back to, you know, my love of Looney Tunes. You know, I used to record a whole bunch of Looney Tunes and go through and freeze frame all of the animation. Mm. And once I started knowing, like, oh, this animator did this and this animator did this, like, it became, like, super fun for me to identify, like, those people, like, you know, who animated what scene. And so, like, yeah, for me, Ren and Stimpy, again, yeah, huge influence, and Dexter's Lab. These were shows where the actual animation layouts were based very heavily on the individual board drawings from those storyboard artists. And it gave the shows, like, a special kind of life that I think you can lose if you don't have this artist first kind of way. You know, and even to go back to The Simpsons, which is a very writer-driven show, like, but when you watch those old Simpsons episodes and you see Brad Bird animate a Krusty scene, like, you know it's him. You know what I mean?
Or any David Silverman scene with the fingers are always twiddling.
yeah, exactly. Like, you know who they are, you know, when David Silverman gets to chew on a lengthy Homer monologue, you just are like, I know who this is. And for me, that's really fun. And I don't mind the audience noticing that, hey, this is drawn a little different. It must have been drawn by some guy who works there, you know? Just like the feeling of reading an old Mad magazine, and you start to understand, like, the different artist styles. And even if they're doing similar materials, you're like, well, Sergio Aragonés would like approach this subject matter way different than, like, I don't know, like Dave Berger or like another artist.
Yeah. Al Jaffe.
And so, yeah, exactly. And so, like, yeah, that's something that I'm really all about. And it sort of informed my philosophy in major ways.
Yeah, I had those moments as a kid, too, watching animation. But I didn't know why I felt it. But if I was watching an episode of Tiny Toons, and, like, the animation would switch from, let's say, one
TMS,
yeah, when like it would become a TMS scene,
yeah,
it would become a TMS scene. I'm like, I like this better than that other scene, but why do I?
This looks as good as the opening. How did they do that?
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, and yeah, that was something that I loved as a kid. And yeah, I just want to give that to other kids.
You are a voice actor on the show, which you hadn't really done on the previous shows you'd worked on. So what's it been like to be a regular voice on the series yourself, including scenes where you're like, say, Rad is talking to Daryl.
So I kind of, like, fell backwards into doing the voice. It was literally because on the pilot, you know, pilots are kind of fly by night sort of things, and you have to just get stuff done, like, as soon as possible. So I was just like, you know what, I'll just do these voices. If I ever make it a show, I'll cast someone else, or I don't know. And then it just kind of stuck, and then we were never able to, like, cast someone else or do anything else. So I ended up, like, just staying on and doing the voices. Voice acting is, like, it's strenuous, tough work, but I like it because I have a lot of responsibility throughout the day to make decisions and create stuff and, like, make calls on, you know, design, storyboards, stories, like, everything. Like, voice acting is kind of like one of the times during the day where I'm in a booth and someone else is telling me what to do. Like, it's really nice. The best thing about voice acting, though, has been gotten to sit in the booth next to, like, some of, like, my voice acting heroes. Like, not only do I get to work every week with Courtney Taylor and Ashley Birch, who are amazing voice actresses who have done like several video games and cartoons and amazing work. But then also, like, I get to be in the booth and with Jim Cummings, who is like one of my voice acting, like this is like God to me, basically, like in terms of like, I mean, he can do anything. Like, and like when I do a line and Jim Cummings or say like Dave Herman, who also does like a lot of voices on the show, when I do a line and one of them looks over and it's like, hey, good job on that. I'm like, oh, okay.
Oh, wow. How intimidating.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
It's awesome.
That Jim Cummings thing, that the second I heard Boxman's voice in his first appearance, I'm like, oh, my God, this is the it was just perfection to me, because he is one of the all-time greats. Like, he is like, it's hard to say he's the, I don't want to demean other voice actors from our childhood, but he was like my favorite. He was like the Mel Blanc to me all of us when I realized, Darkwing Duck is also Winnie the Pooh, is also Tigger, is also like, he's all these characters.
Pete. Yeah.
He's
so different.
He's Pete, yeah. He's like Scar's singing voice in Lion.
Yes. Yeah. That. Like,
well, Jeremy Irons couldn't do it.
Well, he bled his voice. The casting of Jim Cummings, like, well, that had to be pretty early in the decision for him to do his villain dude voice, right?
Yeah. In the pilot, so I made the pilot for OKKO. It was called Lakewood Plaza Turbo in 2011 and 2012, and I did have some scenes where Lord Boxman appeared, and but unfortunately, it's a pilot. It's only 7 minutes. I had to cut it down. So I didn't get to reach out to him. But later on, when we were doing our first mobile game and then doing the first short, I got to reach out to him. He was super into it. He just came in. He's an incredible professional. And like, he just like exudes this, like, his line reads are so confident and so fun and so full of energy. For me, I'm like, this is a thing that I made. So I'm like, is this legitimate in any way? And then hearing his voice coming out of the characters, I'm just like, oh my gosh, it's a real cartoon.
Yeah, actually, Jim Cummings is from my hometown, and growing up in the 90s, every kid claimed to be related to him in some way. It's like, okay, he can't be everybody's uncle. Let's settle down here.
That's awesome.
Captain Planet episode just aired, and that was a great one. I especially love, you know, you got back the LeVar Burton and the original voice of Captain Planet, and I especially love, like, LeVar Burton's readings in it, or so he's like, oh no, like, it's such an innocence to it. I really like that. But then it ends on, I also just love the ending. It's just like a bam, slap you in the face, like, oh, the world's, we're doomed.
Yeah, that was super fun to do because, so I wanted to do this Captain Planet crossover. It's easy, I guess, because I work for Turner and they also own Captain Planet. And, you know, I approached it from, you know, I didn't want to actually, like, make fun of Captain Planet. I wanted to do something genuine and something that would fit in with, like, the actual goals of it. And part of that was, getting those original voice actors back, working with them was incredible. Working with LeVar was awesome. As soon as he got back into the booth, like, instantly, like, Kwame's voice came out, and he even sort of, like, took his own spin on some of the lines, and, like, you know, it was like hearing that character come to life again, and it was amazing to meet him because he was a huge inspiration to me as a young, nerdy Trekkie who loved reading. But one of the best things about the Captain Planet episode was, so Captain Planet's voice, David Coburn, is he really embodies that character, and he also really believes in, like, the ideals that that original show was setting forth. And when he saw the original script, that end sort of sermon that Kwame and Captain Planet give, he actually, like, when we were doing the record, he worked with us to make sure that, you know, it was very genuine. That, you know, the thing about Captain Planet as a show is that, yes, it was this cheesy show, but it was never afraid to drop like hard truths about, you know, how bad things have gotten in the world and like, you know, how like if we don't pay attention to our environment, like, you know, we there are going to be like real problems. And like one of the things that he helped us balance was, you know, in the original show, there was always this balance of hard truth, but then actionable steps and optimism, so that there's ways that even you as a kid can feel involved in the fight for the planet. And so he really brought that to that final bit in the show, which was like, you know, he helped us like sort of craft those lines where it's like, he says the hard truth, but he's like, hey, but if we work together today, we can still have a brighter future. And that was something that was really important to me.
So before we let you go, I have one question for you about a really obscure reference I spotted when I just started watching the show. I was extremely surprised and delighted to see just an explicit Clash at Demon Head reference in OKKO. And I want to know if you have any idea what I'm talking about.
Oh, are you talking about the character, a real magic skeleton, who looks a little like Tom Guycott?
Yes, and actually I noticed if you squint, the protagonist is sort of like a squashed down version of the protagonist in Clash of Demon Head. I was like, oh my god, somebody else has played Clash of Demon Head and they recognize how cool Tom Guycott is.
Yeah, that was a game that I played like super early as a kid, and I always, you know, I think it was a thing that like I didn't have a manual for that game or anything, so like I was just kind of making it up in my head, like, yeah. Who are these characters? Like, what is this world? Like, it's so crazy to me. And yeah, that was something that was definitely an influence.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I guess a last question for me. You know, the show's now aired over 30 episodes and seems like it's really chugging along. Like, with these later episodes in this run, like, what have you guys learned from the beginning of the show that you've put into action in these more recent episodes?
So, yeah, what's been one of the most fun things about the process has been, so, you know, these are characters that I've been working on since 2011. These are characters that I've had for a while, and you know, they've become sort of real to me. And when we're working on the show, it's really awesome that like when we come up with a new story or a new situation, the characters almost are like, they feel like they're alive. Like, we know what they're going to do and we understand what their chemistry is. And we have a lot of fun, like, just throwing the characters at a situation and seeing like the fun ways that they would approach it. One of like my best experiences on the show is going into a pitch and thinking like, oh, KO would do this. And then the board artist is like, actually, KO would probably say this because he feels this way. And I would be like, oh yeah, I guess you're right. Like, the characters begin to have a life of their own. And sort of as the show goes on, we have a lot more fun with that. And also sort of dipping into the characters' backstories and their motivations and sort of, you know, having fun with the fact that it's like this big interconnected world of heroes and villains. That's something that, yeah, we go into a lot more.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, one of my favorite moments that feels like that on the show is when it was the flashback episode of Enid and Rad in high school, especially seeing Enid walking around with her like giant stack of manga collections, mm-hmm. and like basically dressing like a Naruto character. I love that. Was that one of those type of additions, or was that a thing you saw for Enid from the beginning?
Well, you know, so yeah, talking about Enid's development, we kind of how had this feel, you know, you put these characters together and they're all kind of based off of these archetypes, you know, that we try to put a little spin on. KO is the exuberant young kid, but the sort of spin on him is that, oh, because he's a kid, he actually sees things in this black and white way, and that leads to kind of problems for him. Rad is sort of like the older bro macho type, but then our kind of tweak on that is that that's like total projection. Is like masculinity is like, it's not a thing that you can take for granted because it's a thing he's sort of putting on himself. Enid is sort of a deconstruction of that sort of cool girl archetype, you know, the sort of sarcastic eye roller. And then, you know, one of the things that we seek to do to upend that is sort of see where, like, where would that have come from? Like, how could somebody project something like that? You know, you never, a lot of characters that are like that, you're just supposed to accept, like, oh, that's just the way they are. But throughout the series, you kind of find out that this sort of archetype is something that built up over several years from sort of an inconfidence in herself and sort of experiences that she had of, like, disappointments when she was young and sort of becoming hard and cold to the world. Like, it comes from a really real place. And in the future, we're definitely going to keep exploring how that, having that kind of personality, you know, would like, what are the logical conclusions to having a personality like that? Like, what would happen if you actually have to be genuine about something or be ambitious about something? Like, how would these things come into, how would they come into conflict and how would they resolve as a character who's like a real living, breathing person?
Well, all right. Well, we kept you long enough, Ian. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
It was so awesome to talk to you about all this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And hey, you know, in the future, I would love to talk to you guys again. I'm a huge fan of Retronauts and Talking Simpsons. You know, I'd be down for all that stuff. If you ever someday get around to talking KO, I would totally guest star on it.
That could be in our future.
That very well could be. Oh man, well thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Ian. So again, thank you to Ian Jones-Quartey for the interview. He was great, and we actually went way over our time, and no one stopped us. Yeah. So I feel like that was all him. So thank you so much, Ian. And if you want to watch OKKO, Let's Be Heroes, I think Cartoon Network makes it fairly easy if you download their app.
Yeah.
It's on iTunes and Amazon. I've been watching it, and it's great. Like, I put off watching it. I'm like, why did I put this off? It's so good. It's, well, it's made for me. Not, yeah. It's not for kids. It's made for me, a 35-year-old man.
Yeah, it is what I love about the show, that it feels made for me, and that it's so many references. Like, would a kid who isn't a 35-year-old man understand these things?
Yes, they don't get the Clash of Demonhead references because the schools aren't teaching them right.
So check that out for yourself, too. It's obviously, I guess it's most free on the app because they are doing... Cartoon Network really wants kids to download the app. That's where it's at for them. Another thing, oh my gosh, I'm kicking myself right now. They are making with WayForward a OKKO video
game
for consoles right now. He's been working with WayForward, like he is making a game right now.
It has to look beautiful. Like,
anyway, yeah, check out all those things, and I hope you guys like the interview. We'll have more cool ones in the future.
And Ian might be back. He brought that up in the end of the interview, so yeah. I was really excited to hear that. So yes, thank you so much for supporting our Patreon, and we'll see you when we do another interview sometime soon.
All right, I'm bored. Everybody out.
Oh, I'm a bad rock.